Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Pardis Kebriyai. I'm counsel for plaintiffs Talal Azahrani and Nashwan Al-Salami, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, this case is unlike other detainee abuse cases that have come before this court, which allege torture pursuant to official policies. As problematic as those policies were, plaintiffs do not challenge them. They allege that their relatives died as a result of conduct that fell far outside those policies.
Do we have jurisdiction?
Your Honor, we would argue...
Section 7 of the MCA.
We would argue that you do. And we submitted those arguments in our brief below. We argued several things. One, that Section 2241E2 was invalidated by Boumediene, that even if it was not invalidated...
Boumediene dealt with suspension clause, right?
It did, Your Honor. The specific
clause... This is not a habeas case, so Boumediene doesn't apply, right?
Well, we would argue that the reasoning of the court in Boumediene does apply in certain
But its
respects.
Reasoning concerned the suspension clause, right?
The reasoning, the ultimate holding of the Supreme Court in Boumediene was about the suspension clause, but as this court recognized in Al-Maghala, the Supreme Court addressed the general question of the extraterritorial...
Al-Maghala had nothing to do with jurisdiction to review.
It did not, Your Honor.
Not a thing.
No.
So assume for a moment that your clients have some sort of constitutional rights. How do we have jurisdiction to decide whether or not they have constitutional rights?
Your Honor, as I was saying, we submitted our arguments in the court, in the district court.
Well, submit them to me right now. I'm asking you about it.
Sure. We argue now that Section 2241E2 is not operative on its own without... makes no sense on its own without Section E2. Two, that even if it was not struck...
Why? Habeas is one thing. Other litigation is another thing. Habeas is particular suspension clause. Other litigation is not. I don't follow. There's a step missing in your reasoning for me.
Your Honor, the very purpose of Congress in passing Section 7 was to bar all judicial review of claims by detainees. That very purpose is now defeated by the fact that habeas exists, that habeas claims can be brought.
Right, so those can be heard, but how does that defeat Congress's intent with respect?
Even with respect to the narrow purpose of 2241E2, conditions, treatment, transfer claims can, in certain jurisdictions, including this one, be brought under habeas, which those are the very claims, the very type
this
of
claims. This is not a habeas claim.
This is damage.
Yeah, this is not a habeas claim. This is a damage case. So the fact that perhaps there could be...
They're protected against congressional decisions not to allow particular damage claims.
Your Honor, again, we believe that that's one of our arguments, is that 2241E2 was invalidated. But there's the broader question of the constitutionality.
We know, do we not, that... The Supreme Court says that the Bivens remedy should not be implied where special factors counsel against it. And the strongest, most commonly indicated special factor is that Congress has in some way or other indicated an intention that the Bivens remedy not exist. Well, so far as the Bivens remedy is concerned here, Congress appears to have indicated in the clearest possible way that the remedy should not exist.
Your Honor, Section 7, in barring all judicial review of...
Let's work it through action by action. Bivens first, then
ATM. That's correct, ATS. But I'm addressing your point about Section 7 as a possible expression of congressional intent with respect to Bivens claims.
It's a little stronger than congressional intent. It's congressional meaning.
Yeah.
It's a pretty firm...
Well, our position is that Section 7 is unconstitutional and void.
Why is it unconstitutional? I'm not following you on that.
Your Honor, our arguments are in the record below, and our position with respect to the constitutionality is one, that in barring any federal forum for all federal question claims, Section 7 exceeds Congress's power.
How long did the courts of the United States exist before they got federal question jurisdiction?
Your Honor, since the founding, there has been some form of federal
when
review.
When was the first statute that gave federal question jurisdiction to the federal courts?
I believe it was 1875.
Mm-hmm. So for about a century,
well, there is,
the courts were unconstitutional in your view?
There has been, no.
There was no such
Honor,
remedy
since,
in the federal courts at all for anything like this for at least 100 years.
Your Honor, Section 7 removes Supreme Court appellate review of fundamental claims of constitutional importance. In that sense, Section 7 goes beyond.
No, you can't. That argument gets you nowhere in this circuit because we've held that there is no constitutional claim that can be mounted by an alien in Guantanamo. And you may disagree with that, but and we reiterated that after Boumediene. So the fact is that your clients under the law of the circuit have no constitutional rights other than to bring a habeas action. But so I don't see, so we get back to the question, given that and a single panel here, we can't overrule the precedent in the circuit. Given that, how can it possibly be that Section 7 is unconstitutional? It deprives your clients of nothing that they already have.
Your Honor, I think that this court, after Boumediene in Almagala, recognized that Boumediene, the reasoning of Boumediene and the discussion in Boumediene addressed more than just the suspension clause. Though the court in Almagala said very explicitly.
What do you do with Kayemba? Kayemba said that the holdings of this court that aliens without property or presence in the United States have no constitutional rights under the due process clause or otherwise. And we held in Kayemba that the law of the circuit, which is what I just stated is the law of the circuit, survived Boumediene.
Your Honor, that formalistic approach to the question of extraterritoriality was clearly rejected by the Supreme Court, and there is language in Almagala.
Wait. You're missing my point. After Boumediene, we reiterated and held that was still the law of the circuit in Kayemba. So what do you do with that?
Well, Your Honor, we would respectfully submit that is
incorrect.
Against.
Your
that
argument
is
that's incorrect. But
it's
we can't. But a panel
incorrect.
Of this court can't overrule the law of the circuit. And there's been no Supreme Court decision after Boumediene or after Kayemba that changes any of that.
Well, we would, Your Honor, then submit.
So what we're dealing with here is a potential petition for rehearing in bank. This is your own.
If the position is that even after Boumediene and even after this court's decision in Almagala, where very clearly the court said the Supreme Court addressed the general question of the extension of constitutional
Kayemba
rights.
Kayemba is what it is, and Almagala did not deal, though Judge Randolph and I are asking a slightly different question, but Almagala did not deal with jurisdiction to pass on other constitutional claims. It may have said that, and did say, that the Supreme Court's reasoning in Boumediene has influence on the question of existence of other constitutional rights. But it didn't say anything about the jurisdiction to adjudicate those rights. And Congress very plainly said in Section 7, we don't have that jurisdiction.
Your Honor, Congress can't act unconstitutionally.
Right.
And
it, for 100 years, beginning with the first Congress, it didn't give jurisdiction for this sort of thing at all.
But it did give at least Supreme Court appellate jurisdiction since.
What does that have to do with whether we have jurisdiction or not?
Well, that has to do with whether Section 7 is valid and whether it's constitutional.
I interrupt
in the sense
you,
that it goes beyond.
Train of thought, I think. Have you got an answer to anything you think we can do with Kayemba? I mean, Kayemba.
Your Honor, we would submit that the statement in Kayemba was not even a holding. It was dicta.
No, it was not. That was a holding because the Uyghurs in that case argued they had a due process right to be released into the United States, and we rejected it on the basis that the due process clause doesn't apply to Guantanamo. That's a holding.
Your Honor, then we would respectfully submit that we disagree with that statement, that it's been clearly rejected by the Supreme Court. There are, however, separate from the constitutionality of Section 7, other ways that we argue that Section 7 doesn't apply to these men. The fact that the only enemy combatant determination that these men ever had was by CSRTs, the Supreme Court found wholly inadequate for the purposes of determining whether they were lawfully detained. The fact that 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 tribunal decision, which lacked basic elements of fairness, lacked the right to an appeal, lacked the right to counsel, lacked the right to notice, all of those flaws.
Again, the court identified a couple of defects in that process, as it found. Is there any indication that those defects are relevant to the findings here with respect to the plaintiffs?
It goes to the fact that the CSRT enemy combatant determinations cannot serve as the trigger precluding all further.
What are you not answering my question? I mean, the court there pointed to specific defects. What I'm asking you is, were those specific defects in any way relevant so far as the findings regarding these plaintiffs is concerned?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor, but to the extent that these men had those very tribunals and that their enemy combatant status was determined by those tribunals, and for that reason, they are now being barred from all further judicial review of constitutional claims, the Supreme Court's holding is relevant.
There's no constitutional error in that determination. Then, regardless of the general rule on CSRTs, it's not clear why it makes 7E defective with respect to these plaintiffs.
Your Honor, separate from that question, I think there's evidence that Congress didn't even know or intend that the CSRTs would be found to be as inadequate as they were, that those decisions were not meant to be the trigger, were not meant to be the trigger for the severe bar of Section 7.
What do you do with the final phrase of Section 7, or is awaiting such determination? Even if they had no determination, you don't need a trigger, do you?
Well,
if they're just being held there, and we're going to determine someday what their combat status is, isn't Section 7 applicable?
Your Honor, I think Congress still anticipated that every single detainee at Guantanamo would have a CSRT tribunal, and further, that they would have a right to limited review in this court of those determinations. These men died before they had that chance. All they have is the very flawed CSRT determination that would now serve as the basis for precluding all further judicial review of colorable constitutional claims, even if there's disagreement about whether they actually have due process rights. All further colorable claims that they may have, it cannot be that Congress intended that the CSRTs...
The question of jurisdiction applies not only to your Bivens claims, but it also applies to your claims under the Alien Tort Statute. Is that correct?
Your Honor, the government below did not raise Section 7.
I know they didn't, but it's a jurisdictional question, so that doesn't matter. But on the face of it, it seems to me that Section 7, if Section 7 is not unconstitutional, it bars not only your Bivens claims, but also your Alien Tort claims.
Well, to the extent that it does, right, we would argue that it exceeds Article 3 in precluding all federal review of federal question claims, such as claims under... Okay. The laws of the United States.
I mean, suppose Congress simply amended the ATS to create this exception, an exception for people covered by the language of 7E. Would that raise a constitutional question, and what would that constitutional question be?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand. If they amended the ATS to allow for...
You simply say it gives right of action to aliens. But suppose it amended it to accept aliens and used exactly the same language that it uses jurisdictionally in 7E. Is it a constitutional issue?
I think, Your Honor, it would be.
Is the Constitution?
Well, to the extent that there would be no review, no federal review by a district, lower federal court or the Supreme Court.
Let me give a simpler hypothetical. Suppose Congress repealed the ATS, okay? That's a constitutional problem?
Your Honor, I think that what Congress could not do, and I think what the Supreme Court has never upheld, is a complete preclusion of review of constitutional claims.
Nothing constitutional.
So if we're talking only about international law claims, I think that would be a separate matter. The particular problem, one of the particular problems with Section 7 and what I think the Supreme Court and this court has made clear, that when it comes to constitutional claims, due process claims that we present here, that there would be no judicial forum at all, whether at the state level, the federal level, by the Supreme Court, original jurisdiction, appellate jurisdiction, anything, that would be a problem that I think all agree would present serious constitutional claims.
This is your Bivens, your correct Bivens.
With respect to ATS, I think it would be a separate matter if Congress decided to withdraw the ability of detainees to bring ATS claims. I don't think that would present the same sorts of constitutional
claims. So your constitutional objection to 7E disappears with respect to the ATS?
Not exactly, again, because the ATS still presents federal question claims, and barring federal review.
The federal question is easily answered by exclusion.
That's pretty easy, ain't it?
Yeah, right.
If there were no federal review of federal question claims, our position would be that that exceeds Congress's authority under Article 3. Congress
cannot.
There isn't
a federal question claim if there's a repeal of. There isn't a federal question claim under the ATS if Congress repeals the ATS.
Your Honor, I don't know that if there is a federal question issue and claim, and there is an inability to bring that claim or to have review of that claim.
In my hypothetical.
Then it would present Article 3 problems.
Can I ask you, let me start with the Supreme Court. Has the Supreme Court recognized a Bivens action with respect to the Eighth Amendment?
Yes, it has, Your Honor.
In
Carlson.
Carlson, okay.
Which, in our mind, would be very similar to the substantive due process claim that we allege here for an arbitrary deprivation of life.
And if there is a Bivens claim under the Eighth Amendment with respect to cruel and unusual punishment at Guantanamo, would that claim for aliens who have no connection with the United States other than being at Guantanamo, does that apply to Bagram too?
Your Honor, I think that Bagram, our position aside, I think we would argue, if I were here talking about Bagram, that it would apply.
So but separately, anytime the military, I just want to get the breadth of your theory here. Anytime the military captures anybody, any place in the world, and that individual has a potential Bivens claim against the military for cruel and unusual punishment.
No, we would not argue that, but we would argue that.
I don't see your arguments geographically confined.
It would be, Your Honor. I think
the habeas stuff is different, because habeas corpus traditionally, historically, has always had a geographical component to it, the territorial jurisdiction of it, and even the Supreme Court recognized that in Boumediene. But the cruel and unusual punishment argument that you're mounting here, I don't see any geographical component to that. So why doesn't it apply throughout the world?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would depend on the situation and the facts.
Usually does.
Whether,
yeah.
I'm sorry?
Usually does.
Yes, but I think based on the practical approach, not just the specific factors identified in Boumediene about the application of the suspension clause, but the practical framework that the Supreme Court discussed in Boumediene, if there were where the question is not about formalism, but it's about whether there are objective factors and practical considerations that would make resolution of the claim difficult, I think there could be geographical limits. Bagram is a very different situation than Guantanamo. Guantanamo, we're talking about territory that the Supreme Court has said, in every practical respect, is U.S. territory, where there is complete U.S. jurisdiction. And so if we're talking about Guantanamo, I think it's clear.
But if there's cruel and unusual punishment, it doesn't matter whether it's on the soil of a foreign nation or an area the United States leases or a temporary military base, because the focus of the cause of action is what is done to the individual, not where it's been done, which is why I have this
right. I mean, question. I think that if taking the practical factors identified in Boumediene, so the status and citizenship of a detainee, the location is factored in. We're not talking about an active war zone at Guantanamo, but we may be talking about that, or we are talking about that with respect to Bagram. And any other inherent obstacles to resolving the claim, those factors would all come into play, and they would determine whether the extension of the Eighth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment would be practical, impractical, or anomalous in a situation.
Sounds like a legislative question.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, we would submit that that's squarely a judicial question, as it was with respect to the suspension clause.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We have talked to you well past your time, as is our custom. We don't abide by the lights the way the Supreme Court does. So thank you. We'll hear from the respondent, appellee, excuse me. Give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal if needed.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Loeb from the Department of Justice, and I represent the defendants in this action. Turning to Section 7, which deprives the courts of jurisdiction over these types of claims, the plaintiff's objections to 7-7 are all based on a false premise that there is a constitutional right to a damage action, that if deprived by Congress, somehow violates Article 3. But we just know that is not the case. We know that such actions can be deprived by Congress themselves. Bivens itself talks about that it is only providing this common law damage remedy absent affirmative action by Congress. And that affirmative action can be providing a remedy, it could be providing an administrative remedy, as we see in this case, or it can be a congressional statement that such an action is not allowed. We also know that such actions can be barred by different kinds of immunity, absolute immunity, common law immunity, and statutory immunity. In the Castaneda case, which was recently at the Supreme Court, we saw there the constitutional claims were barred by a statute saying that it was inappropriate and that you would be left to only sort of FTCA remedies. So where Congress is clear about such matters, there is no constitutional defect.
Has there been any hint from the Supreme Court since Bivens suggesting that, as you say, the approach they took in Bivens, making it a matter of something courts do unless Congress has spoken or signaled in some way. Has there been any retreat or change in Supreme Court jurisprudence since Bivens?
Well, as the circuit courts have widely recognized, and as Malesko itself states, the initial premises for Bivens were on grounds that have sort of shifted over the years. And that since then, since the initial decision of Bivens and Carlson, that the Supreme Court has not extended any further Bivens actions and has, for example, in Wilkie, found that it's basically either a matter of either special factors or any congressional statement or remedies. If Congress provides a remedy or states about how it
should. Your argument is that rather than expanding or giving additional constitutional legs to Bivens, if anything, the movement has been the other way.
I think that's very clear and has been recognized widely by the circuits, and that the Supreme Court has said in Chalicki and in Wilkie and again that the courts need to be hesitant before using their own authority to create a money damage action where Congress has not provided one, and certainly where in this context of a damage action by a military detainee during an armed conflict. This court's holdings in Ali and Rasul are control as to that it's inappropriate for a court on its own to do so absent action by Congress. So that's controlled by circuit precedent, and certainly the district court didn't abuse its discretion here in refusing to reopen this case, which is controlled by Rasul and more recently controlled by Ali in that respect.
It seemed to me that in your brief you did not press very aggressively on the 7E. Mm-hmm. Issue.
Well,
I was wondering to what extent this is a department policy.
You know, the district court didn't rule on that basis initially, or
it is jurisdictional.
And we pointed out in our jurisdictional statement and make a full blown Roman numeral argument in our brief. We thought it was appropriate to first address the arguments that the district court did address, and we think under Sinocam that this court has authority to. To in leeway, as the Supreme Court says, in choosing between threshold grounds, and that even if we were to reach the Section 7 argument and agree with us that there isn't jurisdiction over these claims, that it would be also prudent for this court to, in the alternative under Sinocamp, say that Ali...
Do you think the qualified immunity issue is a threshold issue?
The
sort that the court has talked about.
Well, you know, what qualifies as a separate threshold ground is still, you know, fertile new ground. But we know from the qualified immunity appeals themselves that the reason that those are appealable is are considered...
You have to step a bit over the threshold to decide whether qualified immunity is there or not, don't you?
That's
I mean, you begin a merits examination, in a sense, on that. So
well,
it doesn't sound as threshold as...
The reason the interlocutory appeals are allowed in those cases is that they consider the question of whether immunity attaches not to be a separate issue from the merits, even though there are some merits.
But the immunity is from trial and not from liability, not just from liability.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But you still have taken at least a peek at the merits.
And so, too, the question of whether there's a cause of action. I think in the Second Circuit Arar case, there, too, there was a question of whether there was jurisdiction there under the Immigration Act. And the question whether they should recognize a cause of action. And there, the Second Circuit, both the panel and the embank, said even though there were questions about the jurisdiction under the Immigration Act, they would, under Sinocam, go ahead and reach the threshold issue and rely instead on that there's no cause of action.
Yeah, on the jurisdictional question, I think counsel for the plaintiffs is correct that the government below did not argue that the district court lacked jurisdiction of the alien tort claims. Why was that?
That was an error, Your Honor. The statute's very broad as to any claims regarding conditions of confinement or detention.
It says claims against the United States and the alien because you substituted. These are now claims against the United States.
It also refers to claims against the agents as well.
Right.
So it would apply to and you know obviously that was an oversight in the district court. And in our you can see in our brief on appeal we don't make the we say all claims and so in that regard in their argument they point that the Carlson case is establishing Bivens rights under the Eighth Amendment. The fact that it's in one context in a routine domestic prison context doesn't mean there aren't special factors in having this Eighth Amendment or due process right recognized in the sensitive context of military detention, where a court would have to look into what were the detention policies, what was the nature of this alleged new detention facility they claim, was it authorized, who did what there, et cetera. The Wilkie case, for example, it said that was special factors said there shouldn't be a Bivens action in that context. Well, there was a substantive due process claim there. It wasn't that substantive due process was not clearly established and recognized in other cases as a basis for a Bivens action. It was just the sensitive context and the problems in that context of recognizing Bivens action which created the special factors.
You know what happened to Bivens, by the way?
What happened to Bivens?
Bivens was decided on a complaint.
Right.
By Webster Bivens, who was residing in the Atlanta Penitentiary. And it was 6 versus 6 unknown named agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. It turns out there were only 5, and it was settled for $100 an agent because there was nothing to it, the complaint. What's that got to do with this case?
Well, and even when there's only a minor damages, the fact that these individual defendants who are you know working to serve the government are being dragged into court in these cases to face personal damage actions regarding military detention abroad involves the courts you know deeply and sensitively into these matters and subjects them and future military officials to suit. So even whether damages are small at the end, as the Supreme Court has recognized, the fact of the immunity they have is immunity for suit, and so too the same kind of concern should go into likewise into the whether to recognize a cause of action and to the jurisdictional.
Well, that's true. Bivens went on for years in discovery. And it was done pro bono by Sullivan and Cromwell, and they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars or would have gotten those fees. You're correct about that.
I'm happy to address any of the other grounds the district court relied on in its holding to say that it would not reopen the case under Rule 59. Obviously, as we state in our brief, that was not an abuse of discretion, and we ask that the court affirm the district court's ruling.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, we'll give appellant back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to address a few points that the defendants raised. One is with respect to Section 7, just this point that there should be some valid congressional intent extracted from Section 7. Again, our position is that that is an entirely unconstitutional and void statute, and there cannot be valid congressional expression of intent extracted from a void and unconstitutional provision. This court in Bartlett looked at a provision of the Medicare Act.
If we don't declare Section 7 unconstitutional, do you concede we don't have jurisdiction?
Your Honor, you could still find that Section 7 does not apply to these men because the only basis for triggering Section 7 was a wholly flawed CSRT. And
what do you do on the trigger question with the language in Section 7 that says, or is awaiting such determination?
Again,
It would seem that section covers the people that are held at Guantanamo, whether or not they've been determined.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the burden is actually on the side that is trying to bar review. So it wouldn't be our...
We're a court of limited jurisdiction. The burden of jurisdiction is always on the party who seeks the jurisdiction.
It is, but in terms of proving that Congress intended to
bar... Not about intent, we're talking about meaning. It's stronger than intent this time.
Well, I think we have to look at both the legislative history and the plain meaning.
No, we don't have to look at legislative history.
Well, I think...
25 years I've not been looking at it, so I'm not going to start now.
I think there's support for the fact that we need to look at both, and there's evidence that Congress anticipated that every single man at Guantanamo would have a CSRT determination and that there would be at least limited judicial review of that determination in this court.
There would have been if the Supreme Court hadn't switched the deal and given them what it regarded as a superior right.
At the time these men died, which is the MCA had not been passed yet, and what existed was the DTA review of the CSRTs, Congress anticipated that everyone at Guantanamo, including our clients, sons, and brother, would have a CSRT, and that CSRT decision would ultimately be reviewed by a court of law. And these men never had that opportunity.
If they hadn't died, could they have gotten review?
If they had not died, could they have gotten review of the CSRT? Could they have gotten review? Yes, they could have. They had that opportunity, and Congress anticipated that they would.
So where is your argument taking us? I don't see how the death of the detainee can affect the constitutionality.
It goes to the validity of using the CSRT determination without any circuit court review that Congress anticipated.
That review has never been set aside.
Because it was never reviewed because these men died.
It's valid. It's never been set aside.
That doesn't make it valid, sir. That just means
it's legally valid. It's never been set aside.
It's an
existing judgment of a tribunal within its jurisdiction.
Your Honor, the CSRTs were found to be wholly inadequate in determining the legality of detention.
Let me ask a preliminary question, which intrigues me. A question that's preliminary to maybe everything here. The individuals who are suing are relatives of the two men that died.
They are the father and the son, Your Honor.
And, son. And what country are they citizens of?
They are citizens of Yemen and Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia. What law determines whether a relative, a father of a deceased individual, can sue for damages? Is that Saudi Arabian law or Yemeni law? Or is it the law of the locus where this occurred, the law of Guantanamo?
Well, under
Cuban law? D.C. law? What is it?
Under Yemeni and Saudi Arabian law, they are the proper individuals to act on behalf of their son and brother. So in terms of whether they are the appropriate people to bring the action, we've looked to their local law in determining
So in other words, it's the law of the place where the relative resides?
For the purpose of determining their standing, we have looked to Yemeni and Saudi law, which makes them the appropriate representatives for their
relatives. But given Steele Co., which requires us to decide Article III standing before we decide anything else, do we have to decide that?
I think, Your Honor, that there are...
Or can we just assume you have standing, which Steelco says we can't do?
I think that that would be an issue that ultimately would need to be decided, but that is among the threshold issues that the court has leeway in choosing among, and the district court did not address that question.
I know. Okay.
If I can make a few additional points.
No, unless my colleagues wish to hear something else, we've talked you past time twice now, and so we will not be hearing any more on this unless my colleagues have questions. So.
Your Honor, I do want to just make two additional points. One
Well, you're not going to get to. We have time limits. Now, we don't abide by them real strictly, but when we've said they're over, we're over.
Your Honor, it is just that this case raises troubling and legitimate questions about whether men in custody, U.S. custody,
close the court,
in U.S. territory